One of our favorite sponsors has returned to kick off this show. That's right, we're talking about the masters of microdosing, Lumi Labs. And they want me to explain to you good people the benefits of microdosing using their Delta-9 THC gummies. If you're stressed out or your mind likes to run a million miles a minute, then you might want to give Lumi gummies a try. They offer indica, sativa, and hybrid gummies that are designed to be taken in smaller doses to maintain a level of calm throughout the day. Or if you just want the pleasant sensation of being a bit stoned, you can take a couple more and you're good to go. I'm not your dad. You enjoy these gummies however you want to. They're one of our longest sponsors, and Scott and I can vouch that they make a quality product, and you can get them sent straight to your door no matter what the marijuana laws are in the state you live. So check out microdose.com and see their wares. If you decide to pick something up, make sure to use the code KINGCAST at checkout to get 30% off and get free shipping. That's microdose.com, code KINGCAST.
I hope you guys are actually ordering from Lumi Labs, because those things actually are fantastic.
Fuck yeah.
As is every product we talk about here on the show, and I've got one to tell you about. You know what I don't have the time to do while running a successful podcast, Eric, is run to the butcher every day to get a fresh cut of quality meat. That's just not going to happen this time of year, or really any other time of year. I'm too lazy for that. But that's why Good Chop has been such a game changer for me. Good Chop offers fully customizable boxes of high quality meat and seafood delivered to your door on your schedule. The products are vacuum sealed and frozen at peak freshness. You can stock your freezer and cook whenever you want. Choose from over 70 high quality cuts, 100% grass-fed ribeyes, USDA prime filet mignon, free range and organic chicken breast, pork tenderloin, thick cut bacon. That's just to name a few. One of the things I didn't mention here is the ground beef, which is remarkably good. We make a lot of burgers over here. We grill out a lot, and everything in the box that I got, and I got a ton of stuff. We got salmon, chicken, you know, a number of things sent to us, but I was particularly impressed with the ground beef and the shrimp, which made, well, not the shrimp, but the ground beef made great burgers.
Your shrimp burgers turned out well?
Yeah. Yeah. unlike many other companies, Good Chop sources its meat and seafoods exclusively from American farms and fisheries. So you can support local family farms and independent ranchers right here in the U.S., and it won't cost a fortune. Good Chop's price per meal starts at just $3.74. So go to goodchop.com/KingCast120 and use code KingCast120 to get, you guessed it, $120 off your first four boxes. The code, once again, is KingCast120 at goodjob.com/KingCast120 for $120 off.
And that leaves one more bit of business to jump into before the show. Of course, that means we have to talk about Fangoria. You know Fangoria, they've been at it for over 40 years, and they're better than ever. This gorgeous magazine is highly collectible and is delivered right to your front door four times a year, each issue filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including your intrepid KingCast hosts. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, never online, so if you want to join in on the fun, you'll need to subscribe. To do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. And, you know, KingCast is in the Fangoria family, you know this. And if you use the code KINGCAST at checkout, you can save a whopping astronomical massive 25% off your subscription.
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Go see a dead body.
Well, sometimes that is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KingCast on the Fangoria Podcast Network. My name's Scott Wampler.
I'm Eric Vespi.
And we are your hosts. Our guest today is a highly talented film critic, podcaster, video editor, and pop culture commentator who owns and operates the excellent film blog Strange Harbors, though you may have also seen his work on The Playlist or the CBC. Today, he's here to discuss one of our favorite Stephen King adaptations, Mikael Hafstrom's 1408, which, believe it or not, Vespi, is creeping up on its 20th anniversary. We are fucking ancient. Do you realize that?
Yeah, my bones just turned to dust when you told me that. I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the KingCast stage, Mr. Jeff Zhang. Jeff, how are you doing today?
Good. Thanks for having me on. I'm excited to be here.
Yes, I'm excited to be talking to you. I'm going to kiss your ass in public here for a minute. I was familiar with you through Twitter, and I admit that I had not read Strange Harbors until, I don't know, probably around the time I followed you, like a few months ago on Twitter. And I was delighted to find a new movie blog to read where the fucking writing is just excellent. I think you're a tremendous writer and film critic, and I'm just delighted to have found that, because I feel like, you know, Vespi and I both worked for movie blogs over the years, and they're all dying. It's harder and harder to find like good, like legitimately good film criticism these days. And
thank you so much. That means a lot.
I mean every word of it. Like, I wouldn't tell you otherwise, but like, it's just every fucking movie blog is being run by an algorithm now, you know? And so it's like all these places that I used to go for, you know, film criticism are either gone or they've turned into this like sort of Walmart sanitized, I don't know, fucking corporate machine nonsense. But you're doing it right. There's a few other people that are out there doing it correctly, or what I would consider correctly. So congratulations on not being a dipshit in the world of film criticism.
I mean, the AV Club's being written by AI now. How sad is that?
Right? Isn't what a fucking turn of events that is.
It's so like, awful. Like a site I used to read like every day of my life.
Religiously. Yeah.
Religiously.
I want to talk to you about what your pick for the best movie of 2023 in a second. But before we move on to that, I'm curious, what do you think we do about that particular problem? Or is there anything to be done about it? Is the genie already out of the bottle?
I hate to say it, but I think the genie's already out of the bottle. Like, what can you...
I agree.
You do. Yeah. All the good publications are folding. I don't know. It's just a really sad sight to behold. And, you know, these publications, they just want those clicks. Mm-hmm. Hate clicks, bait, low effort listicles, things like that. It's
right.
Not what it used to be. So
no. I feel like that the AI thing is just kind of the cherry on the top of the shit sundae, you know, really, because I don't, if AI had been a viable thing that had come about, say, in 2010 or 2011, mm-hmm. I don't think it's an instant switch over the way it is now. But it's when I left Ain't It Cool in 2017, I was actually offered, somebody was like, hey, you know, I'll fund your, you know, you doing a startup, you know, essentially a new website. I'll fund a Ain't It Cool 2.0. We'll bring in all the best voices of the site. You know, you can shed all the stuff that is problematic and terrible and, you know, and focus on all the stuff that we did, you know, that was good. Right. And we can like go back to the good old days. And I took, you know, I was tempted, but I looked around and I'm just like, I don't see a path forward for a site like that these days. I just don't like, right. That was 2017. So that we're talking 7 years ago now. Right. And, that was then. And I think that the landscape having, as you said, been dominated so much with these algorithm stuff, this pivot to video, like that didn't work out and only killed every fucking blog that's out there. You know, it's all these steps led the way to, okay, every website now, especially movie websites, essentially kind of an online people magazine, right? And it's only the lowest common denominator stuff, and there's not a curiosity I feel from a lot of newer film fans. They want their stuff in bite-sized chunks. They don't want to sit and read and, you know, something deeper. So you have all this stuff you know, that's all compiling to when AI finally turned up, then it's like, of course AI can write a listicle. AI can explain the ending of Jaws to you. You know, it's like, you know, it's like, of course, you know, but that's where we want kind of you know, gotten to and trained everybody to expect from these things, you know?
Yeah. So. I think we're at the point where it's still like, haha, funny to laugh at the mistakes that AI is making in writing these articles, just making like super obviously wrong, saying super obviously wrong things and making mistakes, but that AI is only going to get better, and it's going to be much, much worse when they're barely passing for human and you can't really tell, but the quality of the writing still pretty bad. You know, it's
is this just a bad writer or is it a computer?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing we noticed recently was, and we, I mean, me and somebody else I won't name here in case this gets them in trouble, but like we were talking about, I'm realizing I probably can't tell this story on air. But here's the point of the story. I'll skip the story and just tell you the bottom line. Here's our theory. People who are in managerial roles, who are not necessarily writers, but have somehow found themselves in charge of writers by either like buying up websites or launching their own companies or whatever. If those people don't have any experience writing for a living, I feel like those people have a harder time identifying AI writing versus people that do read a lot or especially other writers. Like you can spot it a mile away. Mm-hmm. But I recently found myself in an argument with somebody who is not a writer and has never spent any time with it about whether or not a thing was AI. And to me, it was like, it could not have been clearer. You know, it was like somebody slapping you in the face to read this thing. And they were like, I don't see what the problem is. And it occurred to me that maybe that's the trick here is it, like most people cannot string together a paragraph if their fucking life depended on it. But maybe they also won't recognize this shit and that will allow it to flourish. That's my concern. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you're dead on, and that's the reason why everybody, this is something everybody who likes reading online, you know, writing or does online writing should be terrified, because as the algorithm has proven previously to this, people just don't give a fuck. The readers don't care. I don't know where, what the dividing line happened. I don't know where it was, but you know, there was that excitement and that initial boom when the internet, you know, was changing things up and shaking things up. And it wasn't just stodgy, you know, newspaper critics talking about movies anymore. It was, you know, people with real passion behind it, sometimes misguided passion, but you know, and sometimes they weren't the best writers and then they grew as writers. Like, I don't know. There was this exciting, like boom in the late 90s and early aughts where
that was back when it was the Wild West, you know.
It was the Wild West, but people were excited to read about that stuff. I don't think that you could, like, people would be excited to read, you know, about, oh my God, here's this test screening thing. All they want to hear is the gossip part of it, you know.
It's sure.
Like, mm-hmm. You know, I just don't think that there's room for that anymore. I just don't see it. I don't
Jeff,
see it.
When did you start out?
Like writing semi professionally,
like writing film criticism. Yeah.
2017, 2018. I'm pretty new to the game. Yeah. I haven't been
really
doing
this
for
shit.
That long.
Well, I'm impressed.
Thank you.
I mean, your writing voice, it sounds much more accomplished than someone that's only been at this for 7 years. I'm just blowing you in public on this episode. I'm sorry, this is embarrassing, but I do mean that. Like I'm surprised to hear that. Like, you own your own place. You're doing this as like kind of a side gig.
It's definitely a side gig. I pretty much don't do this for money. I feel like if I did, I'd be in trouble. You know what I mean? And you know, I'm extraordinarily lucky to have steady income coming from another place and to be able to do this and be flexible with what I write about. And, you know, a lot of the best writers that we have don't have the luxury to do that. And it's absolutely sad to see, you know?
Yeah. Well, let's move off this topic and briefly talk about your pick for the best movie of 2023, which was David Fincher's The Killer. I think this is a unique choice for best movie of 2023. It was a fucking stacked year in terms of great films. I'm curious.
Yeah, this is one of the best years we've had in a while.
Right? Like, this was like
really
a 1999-ass year.
Yeah.
You know, where it was just banger after banger. I'm curious. You know, I've read your review. I read your best movies of 2023 list. But I'm curious what made this one skip to the top of the list for you.
I think it's a little against the grain and kind of why I picked it. I like to, you know, poke and prod a little bit with my picks, but it's also genuinely the movie I liked the most this year. And for reasons of, you know, it's saying a lot more than you would think is shown on its surface.
Mm-hmm.
People are like, oh, it's minor David Fincher, which I don't agree with at all. I think it's as every bit as incisive as something like Fight Club or The Social Network or Zodiac. It's, I think, up there with some of his best. And it's interesting that you talk about, you know, the advent of AI and people losing their jobs and the gig economy. This movie has a lot to say about exactly that, right?
Yes.
You know, with Michael Fassbender's nameless killer being persona non grata after like one job goes awry, right?
Right.
It's kind of like, you know, some of our best culture writers losing their jobs as, you know, this capitalist miasma descends upon
mm-hmm.
our culture, you know, right. And things become more and more artless. And like the whole movie is about how can you still uphold this archetype of super cool assassin when, you know, you're squatting out of rental cars and
living in a WeWork.
Yeah, setting up in a derelict WeWork. Yeah, yeah. It's just super fascinating movie. And, you know, he's still like this technical fetishist, right? It's like such a technically masterful movie too. The sound design, the cinematography, the performances, the action in this movie is still good. You still get your dopamine hits in this movie, right?
For sure.
So, just love this movie. It's so fun.
Did you get to see it in a theater?
I saw it. Yes, I saw it at New York Film Festival. So,
yeah, it wasn't like it played in Austin for I think a few weeks, if that. And it was like I'll get to it, and then I didn't, and then I ended up watching it on Netflix. And I was like,
yeah, you gotta watch like the Netflix compressed version.
Yeah, I really wish I had made the effort to. I can't believe I didn't make the effort to see a new Fincher in a theater, but it was just like the timing of it didn't work out or something.
Yeah. Mm. It just hits different.
Yeah. No, I saw it big too. And I had the, you know, it is, there's a weird dividing line there. I think it's because it's a movie that's paced in a way that demands you pay attention. And no matter how focused you are at home, there's always something. It could be a reflection on the screen. It could be, you know, an email comes in, an alert comes in. You just break that concentration for a second. And there's something about the killer that really, when you're watching it theatrically, just really pulls you in. And like I had a revelation watching the movie about halfway through where I was just like, I literally thought to myself, I'm fucking loving this. Like, and that's not something that I usually when I'm watching a movie, if I'm those intrusive thoughts come in if I don't like what I'm watching. Not, you know, usually I'm just along for the ride and then I deconstruct it later.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's just something about that movie. Like I was one of the only people that I know from the Austin Film Critics Association that I'm with that I was voting for the killer within the, like, you know, the best movies. I was voting for the actors. I was in like, and I think there was like one other compatriot somewhere deep in there that also loved it. But yeah, it's weird how that this one kind of hit and then went away. You know, I don't really understand it.
It's a very funny movie too.
Yeah,
I think if you're picking up what it's throwing down, it's very, very funny. And, you know, David Fincher's kind of trolling you with this movie a little bit. It's like, oh, you want my hitman movie? You got to sit through 20 minutes of him like jerking off in a WeWork, you know, like, prepping for his job.
That he fucks up.
He fucks up, exactly. It's so funny. It's really funny.
Something else I'll say on the killer's behalf, and this sounds like a backhanded compliment, but I do not intend it that way. In fact, I'll preface this by saying there are people who like to fall asleep watching movies. Mm-hmm. And there are people who like complete silence to fall asleep. I am one of the people who likes to fall asleep watching something, right? But you can't just fall asleep to anything. Like, a movie has to have a very particular rhythm and cadence and tone. And it also has to do with how bright the image is. And, like, there's all kinds of things that go into what makes a movie good to sleep to, for lack of a better
I think
phrase.
The first half hour of this is perfect for that.
It is incredible. I have fallen asleep to the killer I don't know how many fucking times. I love it. And Like, I said that on Twitter, and people, like, immediately twisted it around. It was just like, well, I didn't know it was boring. And blah. I'm like, I'm not, motherfucker, I'm not saying it's boring. Listen to me. Like, it's, like, this is something, like, deep that goes on in your brain, and your eyes are shut, and, like, you want the sound to be in a certain way. The cadence and rhythms of the of the film, it just, man, it knocks you the fuck out. It's like Tylenol PM.
You want Michael Fassbender to serenade you with his platitudes.
Oh, I would love it. Yeah. It's one of my favorite, like, go to sleep movies lately, which is not a knock on the movie. That is a bonus for that movie.
I get it.
Yeah. Okay. So let's move on to the Stephen King stuff, I suppose. Jeff, what is your Stephen King origin story? When did you first become aware of our show's name?
I feel like my Stephen King origin story is kind of boring. I think, like a lot of people, I bet you we've heard
worse.
Then say it quickly.
I think a lot of people, I started my Stephen King journey probably in middle school. I was like a horror curious kid. Mm-hmm. And like, what's the logical graduation from stuff like, I don't know, Fear Street, Goosebumps, scary stories to tell in the dark? It's Stephen King, right? So
yeah,
I don't think they ever taught it in school, but I was definitely curious picking up stuff like Cujo, Misery, Carrie, Firestarter, Pet Sematary. Some of it definitely, like, I was not prepared for as a kid,
you know. Mm-hmm. like 12, 13, like, which one?
Pet Sematary, especially. Yeah. I think both the book and the movie.
Yeah.
I was probably a little too young to be digesting any of that, but I loved it. I loved all that stuff. And I think Stephen King is a writer that I grew up with, and, you know, picking up more of his later works as I grew up. I would say I'm like a fan, but I'm not a scholar or anything. Right.
Gotcha.
But later on, and like pretty recently, stuff like 11/22/63.
Mm-hmm.
I love his non-horror stuff. I love Dolores Claiborne.
Yeah.
Really good. On writing.
Fucking amazing.
Amazing. I like Hearts in Atlantis too. So I've picked up Stephen King here or there. The one thing that I never got into that I always wanted to was his Dark Tower stuff.
Mm-hmm. Oh, buddy.
It's just so daunting to me that, like, I never... Because it seeps into, like, all of his other work.
Yep.
And there's so many threads and so many things to pick on. And there's so many books. But
it's a commitment. If you can get through that first book, which is like a psychedelic Western, you know, like, you know, not quite El Topo, but it's, you know, it's in that realm of, you know, real weird metaphysical Western shit. You get through that, and then the second book's like a fucking summer blockbuster kind of a thing, like a genre summer blockbuster with like horror, sci-fi, all kinds of shit. And then every book after that, like all of them have their own distinct flavor and genre to them. So by the time you finish the series, you've gone through, there's a romance book, there's a fucking, you know, there's straight up sci-fi, there's straight up horror, there's straight up like, There's a whole book that's like The Seven Samurai with werewolves, robot werewolves. It fucking rules. Like, if I would highly recommend that you you give that one a shot and just pick up the first book. See how you feel about it. And
as they say, there's nothing to it but to do it. Like, it's one of those things, the first book's really short too. If you can make it, I don't know, three chapters into book two, you're going to know if this series is for you. You know what I mean? So it's like, and then it becomes, the daunting part is out of the equation, because then you're just going to be excited to find out what happens next. So
absolutely.
But once you get to the beginning of drawing of the three, you're either in for the whole ride or you're not. So,
So you mentioned you were reading these books at a young age. Were your parents big readers?
No, I wouldn't say they were big readers. They didn't really control my media or literature consumption, so I was free to do what I wanted. But yeah, I mean, I was just a horror curious kid. And, you know, my love for horror kind of went away for a bit, but it came back with a passion. I wouldn't say recently, but like 6-7 years ago. And like horror is like my favorite genre now, you know?
Yeah.
Reading it, watching horror movies.
What caused it to go away? Do you know?
I don't know, just school, college, just media consumption being at an all-time low during
sure
that time of my life. But
you were focused on real world shit is what you're saying.
Yeah, I guess.
And then then you found solace from that in the horror, which is what it's there for. It really is.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's something about horror as a genre that is, it has extremely high highs and extremely low lows in terms of the content that's out there, I guess, for lack of a better word. But when horror works, man, there's no other genre of storytelling that like is as effective as a good horror
story. Hey, I love when it doesn't work either. Bad horror is like one of my, not even guilty pleasures, it's one of my pleasures. I just like watching bad horror.
Trash horror.
It's good stuff.
Let me introduce you to a movie called Sharks of the Corn, which we mistakenly thought would be a fun thing to do on our Patreon because it's a mixing Jaws and Children of the Corn. And let me tell you, that wasn't a fun thing to actually do. And it became very, very hard and tedious to get through.
Yeah, we made a mistake on that one. That shan't be repeated, but... I think that horror as a genre has probably one of the weakest, like, hit to miss ratios. But the thing is, when it hits, it's like the high is higher than any other genre, right? So it's like, I'll watch whatever garbage trash horror I might stumble across. I'm like, after scanning through a fucking Amazon Prime queue, you know, you go all the way to the right until the thing runs out. And it's just like a guy who like filmed a thing in his backyard. Like, I'll watch pretty much anything.
Or your average Tubi page.
Yeah. Let's not invoke Tubi, the horrors of Tubi. But yes. Like most of it is garbage. You know, it's just like, this is a thing to have on in the background. I'll pay attention when, you know, a good kill is happening or something like that. But man, when you get a good fucking horror movie, it's like, man, there's nothing better than that. It's like a great comedy, you know, like you just don't see it that often. And when you know you're in the presence of it, I think it's legitimately exciting in a way that it's not for me on other genres.
Yeah, I agree.
So the title you have brought us today is one that we've actually not discussed that often on the show. I think we've only covered this a couple times, right, Bestie? Yeah. Like Flanagan came in and did this early on. Yep. And then didn't we do another one on this?
Yeah, I'm sure we have. Yeah, it's I know we've covered it a few times on the Patreon as well. It's one that we keep going back to because 1408 as an adaptation is really interesting in that it's kind of the sneaky, really great Stephen King movie that it's kind of up there with The Dead Zone when you have to remind people that it exists when they're thinking of their favorite Stephen King adaptations.
Yeah.
And before It Chapter One, it was the highest grossing Stephen King movie. It was a huge hit when it came out. It was like it made a lot of money. But it's one that like hit and then kind of disappeared, but it's just such this like really fun, inventive, you know, creepy haunted house story that I think maybe gets overshadowed by his most famous haunted house story. One of the most famous haunted house stories, the haunted hotel stories, in particular, The Shining. So, yeah, I always love it when a guest, picks this title. It's a really fun one to talk about.
Yeah, me too. Jeff, would you be willing to, lay out the basics of the plot of this for anyone who hasn't seen it but is somehow listening to this episode?
Oh, okay. So,
no pressure.
1408 is based on a Stephen King short story, and it centers around Mike Enslin, played by John Cusack, who is a writer and paranormal skeptic that visits purportedly haunted hotels and other locations, and he cynically writes about them, reviews them, and one day he gets an anonymous postcard prodding him towards the infamous room 1408 at the Dolphin Hotel in New York. Mm-hmm. And he travels there ready to, I guess, debunk, or at least prepare to debunk, what he thinks is another marketing bit from a floundering hotel. And Samuel L. Jackson plays the hotel manager, and 1408 turns out to be anything but one of his usual investigations, let's say.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I have a soft spot for this movie, and I love the short story too.
Yeah. So,
well, tell us about it. Like, which version did you come to first?
I came across the movie first. Hmm. So when I talk about me falling back into horror movies, mm-hmm. a lot of people recommended 1408 as a gateway horror movie, which I think kind of fits
right.
this movie yeah. pretty well. And I watched it. I really liked it. I don't think it has probably aged so well, but it has a very, very soft spot in my heart. Like, I love a lot of things about it. And for a movie that's kind of hacked up and focus grouped to shit, you know, there are a lot of things. I think we'll probably talk about them later, like the million endings it has.
Yeah.
the reshoots, some weird ADR stuff in the movie that I picked up only recently because I'm more of a film person now than I was back then, right?
Sure.
But a lot of things I love about it too. I think John Cusack doing like a Nicolas Cage performance in this is fantastic. 100%. I think he flips back and forth being, yeah, he flips back and forth being really, really good and hamming it up. It's really, really good. And, you know, Samuel L. Jackson playing this hotel manager who's so adamant about him not going into the hotel room, and it's super convincing. I really love both of these performances. And you can contrast it with, like, just a couple years later, or maybe like a decade later, right? When's Cell?
When Cell, yeah.
Like, well, that movie.
When did they make it versus when did it come out? Because those are two very yeah. different years.
Like, you can tell.
What do you know, and when did you know it?
John Cusack and Samuel L. Jackson are in that one, too, and I feel like they couldn't even be bothered in that one, you know?
Yeah, you they get have the impression have on that movie that they were like, hey, like a phone call happened, and Cusack is talking to Jackson. It's like, hey, it's another Stephen King adaptation.
Yeah, let's reteam.
We fucking hit gold last time. You want to get in on this? And he was like, yeah, let's do it. And then they showed up, and we're like, oh, this is what we're doing? Okay. it's really, as good as 1408 is, Cell is not good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cell's kind of a tough nut to crack. It's a weird book too, and it's, once you get into the explanation of everything, you start going, "Ha, really? That's okay. That's where we're going with this."
Right.
but it's similar to 1408 in that it's like a nice simple premise. Haunted sure. hotel, you know, haunted hotel room will fuck you up. You know, your cell phone turns you into a zombie. You're like, there's something
yeah.
just really like instantly like, yep, I get it. I get the premise. But 1408, it works more as a movie for sure. And I think a lot of that is in the, as you were saying, like, you can tell that Cusack's invested. You can tell that he's going for something. Like, mm-hmm. you can tell that there's a chemistry that between him and Sam Jackson for their big scene that they have at the top of the movie. You know, like, they're excited to be there. I don't know. And having seen Cell, I can understand why they're not excited to be to be making that one. But it does make a difference. I don't know. I just love the whole concept of this dude that, you know, that he's somebody, he's a cynic, but he has a reason to want to believe in an afterlife. And you kind of realize as the story's unfolding that it's not so much that he's going around looking to say, you know, all this stuff is dumb, is he's wanting to prove that there is an afterlife, because if there is, then his daughter, who died at a very young age, you know, it lives on somewhere beyond here, right? Like, so he's, so you realize that at a certain point that there's this shell of cynicism, but it's really hiding a quest, you know, to find the supernatural that he's debunking all over the place, which I don't know. It's a very rich little character beat that, you know, that I really love about both the story and the movie.
Yeah.
Jeff, you said you came to the movie first. What was your reaction upon reading the short story? Because and here maybe one or the both of you can guide me through this, but my memory is that like King wrote the first part of this story as a prompt, right? And then it was like, well, here's you know, the setup, like y'all finish it. Like wasn't that in the original on writing that came out?
Yes, I believe so. I haven't read on writing in a while, but
I don't think it's in the current versions. But Vespi, do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, vaguely. Yeah, I don't know. I'm gonna come across really dumb as the co-host of a Stephen King podcast here, because that is like ringing a bell somewhere in the back of my mind. But I did not do my due diligence before recording this episode to look that up.
Okay, here we go. 1408 is a short story by Stephen King. It is the third tale in the audiobook collection Blood and Smoke, released in 1999. In 2002, 1408 was collected in written form as the 12th story in Everything's Eventual. Mm-hmm. Blah, 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 blah. He originally wrote the first few pages as part of an appendix for his nonfiction book on writing to be used as an example of how a story changes from one draft document to the next. King also noted how the numbers of the title add up to the supposedly unlucky number 13, whatever. But that's how I remember it. I remember getting the hardcover of On Writing when it came out and seeing this and being like, oh, that's cool. And I think he was doing like, I want to say he was inviting people to send in like their finished version of the story. Mm. And then he eventually published his version of it, you know, which I think is, as far as like haunted hotel rooms or haunted space stories go, it's super effective. There are things that happen to Mike within the short story that I think are like legitimately frightening. And this is a thing we've kind of talked about on the show before, where like Stephen King writes horror stories, but we aren't necessarily scared while we're reading them, right? I think this is one of the ones that does a couple of things that I think are genuinely frightening. And that makes it stick out to me as like kind of a, I don't know. It's a short story, but it feels like kind of a major work in my mind to me because of that. You know, there's only maybe half a dozen King stories or novels that like truly like get under my skin like that. Otherwise it's kind of popcorn, entertainment, but
you know why you feel that way, I think, is because this is him playing around a little bit in that cosmic horror feel that you love, this is something that's totally unknowable. This room in particular is not because somebody died in there. It's, as Sam Jackson says in the movie, it's an evil fucking room.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, that's just it. You don't know why. And it's a descent into madness for this guy who is nothing but practical. And, you know, he's going into this, you know, without any, I don't know, without any susceptibility to it. Like, this is the guy that shouldn't be affected by a story or whatnot. You know what I mean? Like, and as you, there comes a point where you realize about a quarter of the way through this, as he's starting to experience things, the slow burn of it all, the frog in the pot of the story, where it's just, he turns around and the bed's made, or, you know, there's a mint on the pillow as if somebody had been there. And, you know, like all these little things that you can conceivably, like, you've had those moments in hotel rooms where you've gone and seen something different. Like, was that movement behind the curtain? Was that, or is it just my imagination? Am I tired? And like, all this stuff, is my mind playing tricks on me? Like, there's this slow descent that by the time, you know, the painting of the ship, you know, makes the ocean come into the room. It's like all the big shit happens. You are so gradually accustomed to it that you kind of realize, like, is this what it feels like to go mad? You know, is this what it feels like to lose your mind and lose your grip on sanity?
And specifically that point where, like, he picks up the phone and it's like, this is number nine. Like, all your friends are dead. Like, there's something so fucking insane about that. Like, it's like this alien intelligence that's communicating to him, like, and it's trying to speak in, and they do it in the movie too. It's not as scary in the movie, honestly.
I absolutely agree. I think there's an ineffable dread to the short story that doesn't exactly translate into the movie. And I think there's a big difference between, you know, what's scary as prose versus what's scary visually.
Right.
Sure.
Like, I think, I don't know if we want to get into the ending right now.
The
ending is like that too. But also, some of the details that are scary in the short story, I don't think would translate that well visually or as a movie, right? Like, you know, when he first reaches the hotel room and the doors canted to the left slightly, right, and then it's the right and it's the center. What are you going to do in a movie? Just have him, like, observe that through his little tape recorder?
Like a Beetlejuice-ass doorway?
I think it's a good idea that they remove that from the movie, but it's so effective on page.
Yeah.
Right? And, like, I love those little bits in the short story that don't exactly translate one for one into the movie.
You know? It clearly wasn't an intention on King's part when he was writing this. I can't imagine it was, but the short story version of this, I think, accurately captures the feeling of being on a bad acid trip, where, like, if you take acid, and I don't recommend that you take acid, but you should totally take acid. Like, if you do, eventually you'll have a bad trip, and you're kind of not in control at that point. Like, once you've taken the drug, like, you're in for however many hours, right? And there's that feeling, something about this story captures that exact feeling of, like, I'm just in it for the ride now, and this is all happening to me, and there's nothing to be done about it. And specifically that thing with the doorway is a very acid thing, where, like, you know, you would see a doorway and be like, I don't like the look of that. And, like, it's a totally, you're at a Chili's. It's a totally normal doorway. Just, like, calm down. Right. And that is a very nightmarish feeling. It's awful. Don't recommend it to get on a bad trip. But, like, I do think the story captures it. The movie doesn't really do that. But I think it has to do with what Jeff's talking about, how the prose works in a different way than the visual medium.
I think the story itself says that it's kind of like being, what does it say, stoned on bad cheap dope, right? I think it says that in the story.
Maybe.
I totally
not
get
my
it.
Experience, yeah. But yeah. There's something to that I find unsettling.
Ooh, we got a couple of sponsors to tell you about here in this mid-roll. Let's jump right into it so we can get back to this discussion of 1408 with Mr. Jeff Zhang.
Yes.
I want to start off by talking about Drew Buxton's exciting new short story collection, So Much Heart, which is out now from With an X Books. These dark tales have received praise from Nylon, Southwest Review, Chicago Review of Books, and the Southern Review of Books. Among other outlets, Nylon named it, quote, a must-read, writing, Drew Buxton's debut short story collection exposes the wiry underbelly of things. Schemes, addiction, dead bodies, intrusive thoughts, masculinity, American mythology, with a beating heart interested most in affirming the strangeness of this life. Order your copy now at withanxbooks.com/store. That's withanxbooks.com/store. Or for more information, you can visit drewbuxton.com, spelled drewbuxton.com.
Also, we have another sponsor I'd like to tell you about, which is Nightmare Fuel.
the horror writing course from AutoCrit. If you're hungry to write the next great horror story but don't know where to start, this comprehensive course will take you on a four-week journey from the foundations of fear to the final touches that chill to the bone. Described as a must-have in any horror writer's journey, Nightmare Fuel is packed to the brim with creative content, live lessons every week, and more than 15 hours of recorded conversations with modern and historic horror luminaries, including Paul Tremblay, Ramsey Campbell, Joe Kaplan, and many more. All attendees will also gain exclusive access to a live Q&A with publisher Jeff Brown of Cohesion Press. Visit www.autocrit.com/Fangoria now to get 50% off before class begins on Monday, March 18th. You're guaranteed to have a bloody good time. So are there any standout sequences from the movie that, you know, you're particularly fond of?
I kind of like the room is, you know, different from the short story where it's just kind of a giant asshole, you know? right. You know, he's like trying to crawl over to his next door neighbor on the hotel from the outside on the ledge. And then the window just deletes itself, you know, and he's got to crawl back. The hallucinations of the crazy person with a hammer. There are a lot of neat little things that I liked. His daughter's dress through the fax machine. Like, how do you even think of something like that? I love stuff like that.
Yeah, no shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love how people just react to the room outside of it. The Isaiah Whitlock Jr. scene where he comes in to fix the air conditioning like at the beginning of it, but he will not enter the room. And he's just
like, I'm not coming in there.
Yeah. And just the matter of factness of it. It's not like, holy shit, this is like, no, you're in a haunted room or whatever. It's like, he's just like, no, this is my job. Flick the thing. You can do it. Yeah. Just flick. I'm not. Yeah, okay. It's done. And my favorite part of that is like, hey, look, it works. And he turns around and he's
gone. Yeah, he's booked it.
I love the, like, that adds so much personality to the movie and the way that Isaiah plays it. And, you know, and it's all an extension of the Sam Jackson manager character, where it's just like, we know we have this room, and at best we just, you know, we have people go in teams to clean it once a month, and that's it, because if we let a single person in there by themselves, they'll come out raving lunatics. It's like, you know, where it's just a thing that exists that we have to work around. There's something about that just grounds it to our world in a way that I think is both really funny and actually really terrifying, because it really makes it feel like this is how we would have to deal with something like this in real life. We wouldn't have a Ghostbusters, we call, you know. It's like, there is no movie fiction version of, like, you would either just blow up the whole hotel room and call it a loss, or the whole hotel and period, call it a loss, or you would just, it becomes a matter of daily life that these people have to work around, you know?
Jeff, if you found yourself in a 1408, what's your first move?
If, like, I found myself in a 1408? In a 1408,
yeah. Yeah. Like, you get in there, you settle in for the evening, you know, like, you're at a fucking junket, or you're, you know, whatever. You're in a hotel, right? You go in, it's pretty normal right up front. Maybe you notice some weird shit, but then the walls start melting, or, you know, a dead kid shows up, or, a person who, like, with the giant hammer. I was watching this again the other day with a couple of friends, and we were trying to determine whether the, for lack of a better term, the ghoul that pops up with the hammer behind Cusack was like a lady or a dude. And it looks
like Amy Sedaris in makeup.
Fucking, that's exactly what I said. I was like, like Amy Sedaris dressed up like a guy. Yeah. Like in a fucking, like, not a Sideshow Bob wig, but like somewhere in that, not territory. A Sideshow Bob wig. Right. So, you know, things have started to go sideways, Jeff.
Yeah.
You know, you have clocked the fact that this is a bad place. Like, are you just like bolting out of the room? Like, how do you, like, how
well, would I feel
you
like that doesn't work, right? I mean,
Well, you don't know that yet. Like, what is your personal like instinct? Like, would you run or would you be like, I'm going to wait and see, you know, I'm going to bide my time here and see if this gets worse, or maybe I'll just go to sleep.
No, you know? I'm booking it. But if I can't leave and I have no obligation to like write about the place, I'm maybe sleeping. I don't know.
If I'm not on assignment. Yeah. Some years ago, there's a hotel in downtown Austin called the Driscoll, which is, you know, famous for allegedly being haunted. And there is one room in particular in the Driscoll where like a number of unsavory things are said to have happened. And I fucking bullshitted my way in there at one point. Like told them I want to write a story about this. Like I want to come in, I want to stay in that fucking room. I'm going to really do it up and try to summon the spirits.
I'm going to John Cusack the shit out of this.
Yeah, and they cut me a deal because it's like a $600 room or some fucking crazy thing. But they gave me a deal and they were like, yeah, go for it. Like there was no bullshit. I got no warning from Samuel Jackson at the beginning of this. Right. They were just like, whatever. There's somebody here for this, some tourist here for this shit. And I stayed overnight there with a lady. We brought we brought candles. We brought a Ouija board. Like we really tried to, you know, summon whatever might be lurking in this room. And this is the same room where Annie Lennox allegedly she stayed there and said she saw like a dead body hanging from the ceiling or something in the 90s or whatever.
Yeah.
We experienced nothing. We got bored and went to sleep. I don't think that, I don't know. Like if I were in that position, like if some shit had actually gone down that night, like, I don't know. I'm kind of like the sort of person where I have no reason to believe in the supernatural or ghosts or any of that shit, but I would love to see it. So I think I would kind of hang out for a bit and just be like, let's see what happens here.
All right. I think I'm in the same boat. Would you guys ever buy stigmatized property?
What does that mean?
You know, like buy a house or something. Yeah. Yeah. It's like you get a discount on it, but
yeah, there's a great deal on this great house, but it's got a haunt in it.
Do you know how hard it is to buy a fucking house? Of course I would. Like, you know, no problem. I would probably have questions. It would you know what? It would sort of depend on the crime itself.
Okay.
Which is, you know, we're going to go down a dark alleyway here, but like there's some violent crimes that I would probably be like, I can live with that. And other ones I probably couldn't.
Right.
Like, do y'all not feel the same way?
To me, it's all on feels. Like if I go and I'm at the place and I don't get like, oh, this place really skeeves me out. Feels it's just a house that happened to have, you know, somebody broke in and shot the owner or something. It's like, that's one thing. But if it's like one of those places where you walk in and you feel something, like you get goosebumps on the back of your neck and your hair is standing up and stuff, that's not a really viable place to kick your feet up at the end of a long day. You know,
laid on your roots. The vibes are off.
Yeah. So the fact that something shitty happened there, you know, wouldn't affect me whatsoever, but you know, we've talked on the show a couple of times about how there have been places that both Wampler and I have visited where it just felt bad.
Sure.
Right. That have that reputation. Then you go to the Driscoll and it's just like this old fancy hotel. You know, it's like
if I go into this house that we're talking about and I don't get that feeling, if it's purely based on the crime, right? Like if it's a B&E or like the fucking owner got, I don't know, the owner got shot or he killed his wife or the wife killed the husband or whatever. That's like, right. I feel like this is so morbid. Like I could kind of live with that in a way that I couldn't live with. Yeah. A serial killer lived here and kept people in that basement for up to 8 months at a time. Like that, I'm not going to, like, I don't want any part of that shit,
right.
But like, you know, a murderer, I think I could live with. Jeff, what are your thoughts?
I think I would draw the line at serial killer, probably.
Sure.
I agree with you.
But murder, you're okay with.
Yeah.
One off. Yeah. I ain't moving into John Wayne Gacy's house, but.
Sure. Yeah. Have you ever been in a place, Jeff, where you felt weird vibes or like that's.
I don't know.
You know, it was haunted.
I don't really attune to places like that. So, like, I don't think I've ever felt anything like that. I would love
to. That's interesting. Have you been with other people that have attuned to it? I mean, by saying that, you're suggesting that you're unable to do that, but maybe other people are.
So, a couple of years back, we went to the Paris catacombs.
Oh, which mm-hmm. right on.
Yeah, really cool little day trip. I was super into it. I thought it was super cool.
Yeah, I've done it's really yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't like scared or anything, but we had someone in our group who was like really creeped out the entire time, you know? But
did they not know what they
that.
Were getting into?
You know, now looking back, they probably didn't know what they were getting into. I think they thought it was like a museum or something, and it was not actually walking through walls and walls of human remains. So.
Uh-huh.
What was their reaction?
She just had her like eyes closed the whole way through. And
so it was just it was scared of being surrounded by like real bones, right? They're not scared, but just like, oh, you know, I didn't expect this today. I find, weirdly enough, when I've been in those kinds of places, I find myself fairly relaxed and comfortable. I don't know what that says about me, but like,
I'm the same way.
There is something to that's really overwhelming about the just sheer number of, you know, death that you are surrounded by, right? When you're looking
through
the catacombs,
when you stop and think about it,
and I'm seeing tens of thousands of skulls, and this is the surface, right? So that's tens of thousands of people who existed. You know, when you see like, you know, the skulls with teeth, and you're just like those teeth were used to eat things at some point, you know, like that was a person, you know, that this isn't a Halloween decoration, you know, this is like a real thing. I went to Prague for a set visit. I think it was for Hostel Part 2. And I went out there and I had an extra day, and I used that day to go outside of Prague. There's a famous, they call it the Bone Church, and it was, it's this famous place that all these monks, I guess, had taken like the remains of plague victims and like built furniture and chandeliers and stuff out of it. I don't know. It was somehow very respectful within the culture, but like if you've stumbled across that here in Texas, you're in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but there it's something that's beautiful and wonderful. There's this weird, like respectful calmness to being around that I don't know why that's my reaction to it, but that's when I've been in those scenarios looking at this stuff, it's I find myself kind of weirdly calm and like introspective. I don't know why, maybe it's just because I feel like I have to be really respectful of, you know, all these things that aren't just bones. They used to be people, you know, they're not just creepy things, or maybe that's it. I don't know. I'm getting deep and weepy here, but that's my feeling. I don't get this instant terror from it, you know?
Yeah, I totally get it. It's like a place of reverence, you know?
Yeah.
I totally get that. I feel like I'm the same way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Scott, would you be scared of the bone yard?
No,
you know, situation?
In fact, I have a t-shirt that's they have a sign at the Paris catacombs.
Mm-hmm.
That's like a circle with a line through it, you know, like the Ghostbuster symbol.
Uh-huh.
But it's like a skull with like a hand touching it, like don't touch mm-hmm. the bones.
Mm-hmm.
And I have that on a t-shirt. I don't know why this just reminded me of it, but I don't feel like I would be. No, like I don't. I would feel. I guess more or less the way I feel in a. Actually, I would feel less of a sense of decorum than I would in a graveyard.
Mm.
You know, like a graveyard is where everyone's laid to rest and, you know, you're there to pay your respects. It's like, I don't know. It feels stately. It feels like, you know, more bureaucratic in a sense. It's all very organized, right? you turn me loose in a bunch of tunnels with bones and skulls like all over the wall. I'm going to be like, this is metal as fuck, dude. Like, it's unfortunate that all these people ended up here, and I'm not even entirely sure how they did. And I'm sure there's a horrible history there, but like, I don't know. The sight of bones doesn't scare me.
Right. Yeah. I agree. It's cool.
Yeah.
It's just bones. Now, you know, a rotting corpse, maybe not so.
Yeah, I don't want to. It's got a little flesh on it. Smell associated with it. Yeah. You know, I don't. Maybe not so. We much. Don't need to get into that. You know,
I think I'll draw the line there too.
Yeah. It's going to be a little, I don't know, greasier and just unpleasant.
Tactilely different, yes.
Yeah.
Jeff, turning the conversation back to 1408, you can't talk about this movie and not talk about the fact that there's about, by my count, I think 96 different endings to it. which ending is your favorite? I definitely have one that I prefer over the others, because there are some where Cusack dies in the room. There's some that he survives, and then there's like some alternate versions of each one. I think it's where they're just like slightly different. But which do you think is better for the story, that his character becomes part of the room, essentially becomes another victim of the room, or that the character makes it out but is, you know, carries that trauma with him?
I want to preface by saying that I actually love the ending of the short story over any of the endings of the movie. Okay.
How does the short story end?
The short story ends with him basically traumatized, and he's got like these deep psychological scars from his stay in 1408, and in the end, like, he can't even turn the lights on. Like, he sleeps with the lights on, and he's like afraid of the sunrise because, or the sunset, because it reminds him of the light inside the room 1408. Yeah. I love that. It like plays right into
the skeptic thing,
ontological cosmic dread of the short story that the movie doesn't really capture. I think the two things are trying to accomplish different things too, you know, the short story versus the movie.
Yeah.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. But when we're talking about the movie, I kind of prefer the ending where he lives.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm the same. I prefer it on, you know, on paper as well as execution. Like, I think the execution of the he's dead one is really janky and schlocky. That doesn't really fit the movie, because you have the funeral scene, and then he like pops up in the rear view mirror of, you know, was it Sam Jackson's car or something? It's like,
you mean not John Cusack pops up? Because I don't think that's John Cusack there.
So, you get that. But, like, I don't know. I love the ending where he makes it through the whole thing. And so much of this is, like, how much of this is psychological and how much of it is affecting our actual reality. And the fact that the ending where he has the charred tape recorder with him and he plays his dead daughter's voice to his ex-wife. To me, emotionally it works. Like, it ties up kind of the whole trauma of losing a child, and I mean, not that that's ever tied up, but, you know, it circles back to it, and it like proves also that he's not fucking crazy. You know, I don't know. I like that you have that little bit of a acknowledgement that what he went through was real and not just, you know, a psychological break, you know.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've actually only seen the graveyard ending with Samuel.
Oh, Jackson. Interesting.
I mean, I've seen all the other endings like on YouTube because I just
checked. Right.
But like that, the graveyard ending's been the one that's been attached to all the versions that I've seen. I was like, damn it, I want to see like another version, you know, like on Netflix, Apple TV.
Yeah. Clue
when I watch it back on TV. Yeah.
That's interesting, because the version I watched the other day had the ending with, you know, Cusack playing the tape recorder. And as y'all are talking, I'm looking up, you know, via Wikipedia, like what the other endings are. And this, like, I know I've seen all of these at some point. Like, I think I had it on DVD or Blu-ray at some point and watched, you know, the collected alternate endings, all 700 of them. But this shit with the shit with Samuel Jackson at the graveyard sounds extremely elaborate. Based on Wikipedia's description. Here. Director Mikhail Hafstrom said the ending of 1408 was reshot because test audience felt the original was a, quote, downer. The original discarded ending had Mike dying in the fire, but happy to see the broom destroyed. He spitefully laughs as the broom screams in agony. Everything burns and crashes on top of him. At Mike's funeral, Olin approaches Lily and Mike's publisher, Sam Farrell. He unsuccessfully attempts to give her a box of Mike's possessions, including the tape recorder. Olin claims that the room was successfully destroyed and that it will no longer hurt anyone else. He later listens to the recording in his car and becomes upset when he hears Kate's voice on the tape. He sees a little girl in a dress walking on the cemetery grass behind the car, calling out as if she is lost. He then sees Mike's burnt corpse in the backyard. Then he sees the same girl holding hands with her father as they walk away. Olin places the tape recorder back in the box and drives off. The final scene is of the gutted room where an apparition of Mike assesses the death of the entity while smoking a cigarette. He hears his daughter calling out for him and disappears as he walks toward the door. A door is heard closing and the scene fades, indicating in death Mike has freed all of the souls. What? That's way too much. Way too much.
That doesn't work. I mean, what works is that, you know, it seems like what they were going for with these happier endings is that he finds his, you know, closure, even in death, like he gets to rejoin his daughter and it's a happy ending, you know, but I like that as a survivor, like, cause it mirrors the whole thing is about him looking for answers after his daughter dies. Right. Like that shakes up his whole worldview. And the fact that he gets his answers and but carries with the trauma of that discovery and carries that forward with him. But it, you know, it just rings is more truer to the theme that they're going for here. You know,
also the fact that it's Olin witnessing all this seems really fucking strange to me. Like he's a minor character. He's in one scene of the movie.
Yeah. Like why would he be at the funeral? Right.
It'd be like exactly. At the end of the-
like it would be his ex-wife that this would should be.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it would be, it'd be like it at the end of The Shining, Kubrick had Ullman come out and go to Jack's funeral and see all this, you know, this crazy touching thing. You know, it's like this guy who fucking interviewed him once, like, you know,
that's
like,
it's kind of the way it originally ended with that's true. Ullman to the hospital, right? Visiting, Wendy in the hospital.
Right.
Yeah.
Huh.
I think
well, they were both wrong. Fuck you, Kubrick.
Yeah, it's also interesting bringing up The Shining, you know, how King's kind of playing with a lot of things that he did in The Shining here. He has to know that, like, he's already written the definitive Haunted Hotel book, right? He has the definitive Haunted Hotel story. So something I really love about the short story here is how you can find these moments where he's like, this ain't The Shining. But then the solution to destroying the room is the same in both, like it's blowing it up in The Shining and or setting it on fire, right? Which is an interesting thing where like he has these stories where they're both very different, but he still goes, well, fuck it, the only way out is to burn the fucking thing, I guess. You know, it's an interesting parallel that when you compare those two.
I'm sorry, I'm going to tell you, I wasn't listening to you just now. I just discovered something amazing.
Okay,
further on Wikipedia. Well, remember we were talking about whether or not the hammer person is a dude or a lady, right? Listed under cast here is Clawhammer Maniac, Benny Urquidez, an American former professional kickboxer, martial arts choreographer, and actor nicknamed The Jet. So,
oh, that's a bit of information that's fact. Totally worth you ignoring your co-host for. I'm really glad
it was. I mean, it was like he was a non-contact karate competitor who later pioneered full contact fighting in the United States. What the fuck? How did this guy end up in this movie? His Wikipedia page is like fucking enormously long. He's been in a bunch of martial arts movies.
Yeah, I know him from Meals on Wheels, Wheels on Meals with Jackie Chan.
Mm.
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
1984.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Yeah. You mentioned Benny Urquidez. I was like, oh, why does that sound so familiar? Yeah.
Jackie Chan movie. To this. Urquidez performed in the film Gross Point Blank as Felix La Poubelle, a hitman sent to kill a character played by John Cusack. He appeared in 1408 as a spectral killer with a hammer, again with Cusack. Urquidez
is trying to kill John Cusack.
Kickboxing trainer. So here's what we're learning, folks. John Cusack is a kickboxer.
And this dude has it out for him. So John Cusack better watch his ass.
John Cusack, by the way, recently followed the KingCast on Twitter.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, I made a pitch to him via direct messages. I don't know if he's listening to this episode. Maybe when it airs, he'll click the link and give it a listen. But we really want him on. But John, you're bad about responding to DMs. I've tried twice now. We would love to have you on the show to discuss this, and to a lesser extent, sell. But if you know, either of those things sound good to you, we would love to talk to you.
He's only going to want to talk about his one flashback scene in Stand By Me. That's the only thing he's going to talk about in terms of his Stephen King stuff.
Yeah. Anyway, is there anything else we would like to talk about in relation to 1408 that we have not covered already?
Yes. Do you guys know about the Dante's Inferno parallels for this movie?
No. Tell me about them.
I'm not really into quote unquote Reddit brained theories or anything. It's one of those things where you read it and you're like, okay, whatever, right? But I think there are too many things in there that are deliberate and purposeful for it to be a coincidence. And I think it actually opens up the movie a bit. I think it's really interesting. I think it's fascinating, and I don't think it's a well-kept secret or anything. I think the one of the first YouTube results for 1408 is this half hour video essay on this allegory that goes through all the parallels. It's by this channel called Real Delusional Pictures. It has 1.5 million views. So I think this has been floating around for a while. So right. I think the theory goes that, you know, when Enslin almost drowns in the beginning of the movie, it actually symbolizes his exit from limbo into the circles of hell, which begins when he gets to the dolphin, which I think is really interesting. Because why put that scene in the movie if you're not doing anything with it? Where, you know, where he's surfing and then he goes under the waves and
I thought that was something that John Cusack was probably hey,
I want to surf in this movie.
Well, yeah, because in his later movies, he's clearly told the director, I'm gonna be vaping through this whole thing. Right? And I figured maybe when they made this, he was really into surfing and was hey, I need a surfing scene in here. And they were okay.
Yeah.
That was my guess, but I like this better. Please go on.
I will say that they do use that as the way to hide the fake out in the last act where it was all a dream, which I really, really, that's one of my favorite parts of the movie actually is how much time they spend outside where it's just oh, okay. So it was all a dream, I guess. And he's just going about, he's going fucking chopping.
It's most of the third act. Post office.
Yeah. And the fact that it takes so long for them, you know, for that they spend so much time focusing on it, you're like, well, I guess maybe they aren't going to fake me out here. I guess maybe this is just how it ends. And then they go, nope, fuck you. You're still in the hotel.
I think it happens too early for me to buy it at all. I never bought that. He was actually all a dream, you know? Definitely pulling my leg here. And it turned out to be true. And, you know, it kind of kills the momentum of the movie, but
it does a little bit.
Just because of how cool it is, the way they bring him back into the room where, you know, the hotel workers are the construction workers in the post office and they tear down the post office and it reveals the room underneath. It's so cool. That's one of my best. That's one of the best set pieces of the whole movie. It's so cool.
Go on about this Dante's Inferno thing.
The things he experiences in the room, you know, as this sinner who goes through this ordeal to come through the other side. And, you know, depending on which ending you watch, you know,
what is his sin? Skepticism?
His skepticism. I'm not a religious person. So I guess sure.
Vaping. Non-believer.
Yeah. Non-believing, blaspheming, disbelieving in the afterlife. And there's overt stuff in there the freezing temperatures, the toxic sludge coming from the walls, the flood from the paintings, which are all punishments in the different circles of hell in Dante's Inferno. So I feel like it's a little too on the nose to be like coincidental. Right. But there's also like more subtle things that I really like too. Like, you know, if you notice when he's in his delusion that he's escaped, there's like this abundance of fans, like the presence of fans. At first I heard this, I was like, okay, you're kind of pulling at whatever, pulling my leg on this. I don't really buy it. But then along with everything else, I totally buy it, where like it symbolizes the blades of torment and, you know, Dante's version of hell. Cause like he's always being chopped up in the foreground by these fans. You know, when he's sitting at the desk and the ceiling fans on top of him, you know, that shot.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. So like, I really like this reading of the movie. And then, you know, the ending that we all like where he lives, you know, it fades into like this white bookshelf, which has nothing in it. And it's like symbolizes like a purification of some sort, which kind of looks like the facade of the hotel building. Another reason why I like that ending way more than the graveyard ending, you know?
Yeah, it just fits more. Huh. Yeah, it's,
you know, what's really interesting about this is like on this rewatch that I did a few days ago, I was thinking like, this sounds so stupid in the face of that very cogent and I think intriguing fan theory. But I was like, here's how my fucking stupid brain was working. Was like, oh, so they're running him through like the four elements. So there's water, there's ice, there's fire. And I kept waiting for like a scene where he might be buried alive, or you could kind of like smudge it to say like
Earth.
Yeah. Like if he was being like shrunk into a space, or like into a, like a coffin like space, I could kind of see that as being like Earth, as though being buried alive. They never got around to that. But this theory kind of speaks to that. It does speak to that, and in a much more literary and smart way. I'm over here thinking about like Avatar: The Last Airbender and shit, you know. But like,
why didn't Captain Planet show up to help him out?
Yeah. Where's the dirt? Jesus. But I love that.
I can't take credit for that either. I mean, I just stumbled upon it too. And
now this is your theory. You said this is your theory. This is
and you're taking full credit for it. I heard you say I came up with this and I made a very popular YouTube video about it.
Yeah. Good job.
Don't forget that King was an English teacher for a long, long time. So I wouldn't be surprised if Dante's Inferno wasn't on his mind when he was writing the story. Right. But all these elements that you're talking about were in the short story. And then on the other side is that you have Hafström, who's more known for doing kind of more arty farty stuff. Right. And like, I can imagine that Mikhail would have leaned very heavily into the Dante's Inferno-ness of the material. And so I wouldn't disbelieve the kind of far reaching like fan explanation
I would like to correct you on something.
Yes.
And I'm only doing this because I had the same preconceived idea. Mm-hmm. Like Mikhail Hafström, I was under the impression that this was the guy that directed, I don't know what the movie is called, but it's about like a young girl, a native girl who is like riding a raft across like a long distance or something. Huh. Right. Okay. I don't know how I got that idea in my head. Probably because it's another Swedish director, and this guy's name is Swedish as fuck. It's got like, you know, umlauts and all kinds of shit going on. Over the name. But like
all sorts of dots. Yeah, I'm looking it up. I see what you're talking about.
But you look at his filmography. He was churning out fucking horror movies up to this point, and then the Weinstein Company got a hold of him, right? And so they got him on like I think it's Evil.
Yeah. Evil he did the right last... with Anthony Hopkins. Yeah.
Yeah, but this was totally not the guy I thought it was.
Yeah, no, I will admit, I don't know if I'm thinking of the same person you're thinking of. but like in my mind, it was the person who did My Life as a Dog, which is a like a sweet coming of age story, you know, like from the like late 80s, early 90s. But no, I mean, this director did start doing indie like dramas, but you're right, became known like Days Like This is the movie I'm looking at. But yeah, no, I a part of me wanted to try to make save face and go, that's what I meant the whole time, you know, but it just so happens that he did start in drama, but it's you're right.
We're confusing our Swedes.
It is
yet again.
It's all the dots. I'm sorry. The dots confuse the Americans. You know, point taken and correct, and I will correct that for future use. But the you know, the point being is I do still kind of feel like that the approach to this isn't schlocky. You know what I mean? Even the Anthony Hopkins Possession movie that he did, it's not good, but it's you know, it seems like the default approach to genre is a little bit more heady than it is schlocky. And so my point still stands, even though I was completely wrong in the reason why I wanted, you know, I was thinking the aiming it in that direction.
Well, good job, Mikhail Hafstrom. you haven't done much I've actually enjoyed since Escape Plan, The Right. I haven't seen these other ones, yeah. But hey, great job on 1408. I think this is like a really good example of, and this is something we've also talked about before, about how some of the better King adaptations are short stories that you then expand to feature length rather than taking a fucking novel and trying to pack it into 2 hours. Right. The stuff that, they do in 1408, like the film version, to expand it, to pad it out is the wrong terminology here, because I think it all works. You know, it's not like fat, but I think this is a really good example of that. Kind of like The Boogeyman, like where it's like this is 8 sentences on a page, and you're essentially extrapolating that out to a 90-minute movie. I think this is the better way to adapt King, and I think that they absolutely killed it on this one.
Sweet. Yeah, I mean, it's obviously Hollywoodized a bit, you know.
Sure.
They had to put in the dead daughter and this easy trauma for Mike to deal with that's not part of the short story, but it works. I think mostly the performance sells it, and you know, it's absent from the story, but I think that's a good way to approach filling out, you know, a feature length movie. And it helps that the performances are great, and you know, some of the more upsetting images are from that backstory too, you know, when towards the end he's like cradling his dead daughter in the hotel room and she crumbles into like ash. I thought that was such a great like visual representation of that whole thing. It's so good.
A thing and, Scorsese did similarly in what the fuck is Shutter Island.
Shutter Island.
Yeah.
No, it's you know, that you talked a little bit about how what's crazy about this is that the room's just a fucking asshole, and that is the biggest asshole thing.
It's such an asshole move.
He doesn't use the daughter as like, oh, boo, scary, you gotcha. It is like, oh, you have your daughter back, psych. You know, it's just a way to completely break this dude. I love it. And to
kill her all over again for him, it's devastating. And you know, it's not just like, oh, she crumbles into dust and floats away. Like, you see, like, the rib cage and all that stuff in his hands. It's pretty gross. It's
an asshole fucking move.
Yeah.
It's
an asshole move.
And before we wrap things up, I do want to give a little credit to the screenwriters. That's Scott Alexander and Larry Karaszewski, who did Ed Wood and
People versus Larry Flint.
And
Larry follows me on Twitter. We should get that motherfucker on the show.
Yeah, let's bring him on the show. Yeah. And then Matt Greenberg is also credited. I'm not sure what the writing situation is on that. Matt Greenberg did Reign of Fire, the dragon movie with Christian Bale. He did the more recent Pet Sematary remake, the first one, not the prequel. So like, I have no idea what order that was in. I don't know who rewrote who gets what credit, but, when you get, Scott and Larry on a project there, they are one of the more undersung, I think, writing teams in Hollywood. So I don't know. It just goes to show it doesn't always work. Sometimes you get a dream catcher, you get a brilliant writer and they can't make the material work, but you know, you get these kind of high quality top tier writers on King and you get magic. I mean, I think that that's one building block to the secret of adapting King. I mean, I know it sounds basic as hell to go just get a good writer on it, but there's a difference between a good writer or a passable writer and then like kind of a top tier writer. You know what I mean? So
agreed.
I think maybe we're ready to escape the room. What do you guys think? Is it time?
Yeah, I think so.
Wrap things up.
Let's get out of here. Jeff, this is usually the portion of our program where we invite people into self promo corner to tell people where to find you, where to find your website, all that shit. Please, you know, talk yourself up for the next couple minutes.
Yeah, you can find more of my writing at strangeharbors.com. That's my site. You can also find me on Instagram, Twitter, Letterboxd, also at Strange Harbors. Yeah, that's where you can find me.
Sweet.
Right on. And my strongest recommendation possible for all of our listeners to go check out Jeff's site. A legitimately great writer and has a lot of smart things to say about movies.
Thank you so much. You will not
be disappointed. You're not going to find that shit on fucking, well, I was going to name some movie blog, but I'm not trying to start a war right now. Go check out Strange Harbors. Jeff, thank you so much. This was great.
It was so fun.
If you ever find yourself in a fucking haunted hotel room, please let us know and come back. Tell us about it.
Yeah, we'll do.
Many thanks to Jeff Zhang for joining us for yet another rousing 1408 discussion. It seems like 1408 always brings out really interesting conversations. So,
it does.
Yet another reason for us to love that short story in that movie.
Yeah, we don't touch on that one very frequently, but I feel like every time we've done a 1408 episode, it's been kind of a banger. And this one was no different.
Yeah.
And, you know, I realize some of our listeners might not be familiar with Jeff's work, but definitely go check it out. Like, he's a great writer and a real quality, no bullshit movie blog going on over there.
Yeah, I know that we spent a good chunk of that episode in the early part of that discussion anyway, talking about the death of movie journalism in the blogging world.
Right.
But Jeff's one of the solid holders on that's keeping the torches lit for those who actually like movie criticism and don't just want to read a listicle. So support those people when you can find them, while you can still find them.
Yes, yes, indeed.
And yeah, so he was a great guest, and we have another great guest coming up next week and another good title. So for as long as we've been doing the show, there have been a couple of titles that people are like, when are you getting to this title? Like, honestly, books that we didn't think were held in very high esteem by our listeners or by Stephen King fans in general. And we're finally getting to one of those titles, and that is Bag of Bones.
Yes.
And it was really interesting revisiting this, especially with our guest, a returner, one of our favorites, the great Emily V. Gordon, who, co-wrote The Big Sick with Kumail Nanjiani. And she's been on the show before, and she also has a background in psychology. And so she's a fascinating person to talk to about these more heady stories. And I think the episode turned out great, and I'm excited for everybody to hear it.
Yes. If you have seen the Bag of Bones adaptation, Mick Garris's, it was a two-parter, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you saw that and remember the scene where Pierce Brosnan gets beat up by a tree, just rest assured that we will be talking about that at length on next week's episode.
That tree was fucking pissed.
You've never seen Brosnan a tree angry. Oh, my Lord.
See, that's what Blofeld should have done in his Bond movies. It should have been the bad guys of his Bond series should have just hired an Ent to come beat his ass because it works. It just works. I'm sorry. That's his one weakness. Pierce Brosnan. Well, he has two weaknesses, a single earring and angry trees. Those are the two weaknesses. And Scott, do you want to tell the fine folks about what's on our Patreon this Friday?
Yeah, this one's I think going to be very exciting for a certain segment of our listener base. If you've spent any amount of time online in the last however many years, you might be familiar with an artist who goes by the name of Readful Things, and he creates these bespoke action figures and various other pieces of pop culture art, many of which are Stephen King themed. He in fact, like when we had our 200th anniversary episode, he did a like a special little piece. It was the cover of The Stand with Eric and I battling on the front of it. We were curious to know what his process is like and what, you know, talk to him about the various Stephen King creations that he's made over the years.
And he's made a lot, by the way.
Yeah, quite a bit.
Even more than we realized going into this conversation.
Right. And I hit him up and was like, hey, do you do podcast interviews? And he had never done one before and said that he had been kind of holding off to basically get on a show that he actually enjoys listening to. And we hit him up. So he'll be here on Friday on the KingCast Patreon, walking us through that. It's a very fun conversation. He's a delightful guest. You know, the fact that he's never been on a podcast before did not prevent him from, you know, keeping us very entertained. So head on over to patreon.com/thekingcast. Sign up for that. You're also, when you do that, going to unlock dozens upon dozens and probably a few hundred bonus episodes, commentaries, interviews, all kinds of stuff going on over on our Patreon. We like to say that if you're only listening to the main feed, you're only getting half the show. So come over there and please give us a few dollars. We need some money. Thank
you. Yes. We know that there are some Patreons out there that like dish out one episode here or there. Like you get four episodes a month, one every week. Like we make it worth your while. We're not skimping out on the Patreon is what we're saying. Yeah, so let's wrap shit up. I got some South by Southwest movies I got to run to.
Yes.
We'll see y'all next week in the main feed for Emily V. Gordon and Bag of Bones. It's going to be a fun one.
Adios, folks.
Bye. The KingCast is a Fangoria podcast production. The show is produced, hosted, and created by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Scott Wampler. Tira Ansley and Abhi Goel are executive producers. Daniel Danger is our art director, and editing is done by yours truly.